Godspeed with Carol and Michael Hollenbach, Sundays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual practices in an effort to better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. We present views and experiences of the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom, helping listeners gain insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world, and to help people find tools and inspiration for their own spiritual development. I'm your host, Carol Hollenbach. I'd like to begin today's program with a quote that goes, "Even while an ordinary being, if upon hearing of emptiness, great joy arises within again and again, the eyes moisten with tears of great joy, and the hairs of the body stand on end, such a person has the seed of the mind of a complete Buddha. He is a vessel for teachings on thatness, and ultimate truth should be taught to him. After that, good qualities will grow in him." This from Chandrakirti, Guide to the Middle Way. If the spiritual concepts of emptiness and selflessness have attracted you, or baffled you, or perhaps made you feel somewhat ill at ease, we're here today with someone who can shed light on these and other gifts of Buddhism. John D. Dunn is an associate professor in the Department of Religion at Emory University. He was educated at Amherst College and Harvard University, where he received his PhD from the Committee on the Study of Religion. Dr. Dunn is a co-director of Emory's Collaborative for Contemplative Studies, a fellow of the Mind and Life Institute, and an advisor to the federally funded Center for Investigating Healthy Minds. Before joining the Emory community, he served on the faculty of the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and he previously conducted research at the University of Lausanne, Switzerland, and Central Institute of Higher Tibetan Studies in India. In his book, Foundations of the Dharma Kirti's Philosophy, which has been called extraordinary and a milestone in the modern history of Dharma Kirti studies, Dunn focuses on this central figure in the history of Buddhist philosophy. One review calls it a brilliant work and says that Apoha theory, one of the least investigated subjects of Buddhist logic and epistemology, is beautifully explained. This from Shoryu Katsura, professor of Indian philosophy, Hiroshima University. His work focuses on Buddhist philosophy and contemplative practice, and currently focuses especially on the concept of mindfulness in both theoretical and practical contexts, as well as the metaphysics of emptiness and selflessness, something we definitely enjoy getting into today. John, welcome to the show, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Carol. It's good to be here.
Now, we appreciate your coming on and taking time to share your significant knowledge, experience, and first-hand understanding of Buddhism. Why don't we begin first with some basics? And I would like to ask if you could take us, of course, on a brief journey into Buddhism. Where did it come from? Where in the world did these beliefs originate? And around what time in history are we talking? And please feel free to take your time.
Okay, thanks, Carol. Well, first of all, I should say that generally many Buddhist texts start with a statement of humility where the author sets aside any claim to expertise or significant knowledge, so I'll just go ahead and do that, too, in the spirit of the Buddhist tradition, and also because it's true.
Your disclaimer.
My disclaimer, I'll do my best. And one thing to know, of course, is that Buddhism, as it developed in many different ways, different cultures, different approaches, different strands. So a lot of my focus and the way I will speak to you today is coming from Indo-Tibetan Buddhist traditions, and maybe that will become clearer what that means later.
Yeah.
But they do all go back to a common origin, and that common origin is approximately 500 BC. There's some debate about the date of the Buddha's birth, but it's about 500 BC, and it's pretty clear that he was indeed an historical figure. He was born in a place called Lumbini, which is now a UN-protected site in southern Nepal, and he spent most of his time in northern India, what we call now modern political India. There are four great places that mark his life: his birthplace in Lumbini, the place of his first awakening or enlightenment in modern-day Bodh Gaya and the state of Bihar in India, the place where he gave his first sermon on the Four Noble Truths, which are a core of the Buddhist traditions, and that's at Sarnath, just outside the ancient city of Varanasi on the river Ganges. And then finally, the place of his death in northern India, a place called Kushinagar. And this is known as his final nirvana or parinirvana. And these four places, as you can see, are not very widespread geographically. Despite the centralization or localization, if you like, of his early career, his teaching spread very rapidly throughout South Asia, meaning India, Sri Lanka, Nepal, and eventually, of course, into Central Asia, including Tibet, and then East Asia, China, Japan, Korea. And we shouldn't also forget Southeast Asia, of course, Thailand, Burma, Vietnam, and so on.
Yes. Why do you think it spread rapidly?
Well, one of the ways of thinking about Buddhism is that it offers a kind of remedy to a situation that maybe in some ways, if we can be a bit imaginative, is not unlike a situation that we face now in modernity. In other words, society was changing in the Buddha's time. It seems that cities were growing. There was much more wealth and therefore more leisure. There were also shifts in different identities in terms of what persons in societies might do and what might become available to them. So those various kinds of social shifts, in addition to the opportunity for reflecting upon them with leisure, perhaps led to a certain kind of anxiety about what the future might hold. Things were changing for that time quickly.
Yes, something we can relate to today as well.
Something we can relate to, exactly. Much less quickly than they are changing now, of course. Now it seems as if everything changes year by year or even week by week. But even then there were cataclysmic, perhaps, changes in social structure in South Asia. And those changes created a kind of anxiety, perhaps especially about one's own identity. Who am I? What should I be? What is the course to my happiness? And the Buddha's teaching focused especially on this particular issue. What is the course to my happiness? How do I become happy? And that's where these Four Noble Truths that were the content of this first sermon are key.
Will you share with us what the Four Noble Truths are?
Sure. So the basic idea, first of all, behind the Four Noble Truths is that it's not that these are the only things that are true, or indeed that they're necessarily even true for everyone. But for those who are focused upon relieving suffering and attaining happiness, these are the key truths that must be understood. And the first of these is the truth of suffering. Now, the word here that we translate as suffering, or dukkha, literally means actually Some say that it has to do with the axle of a chariot. If a chariot axle is not rolling very well, it sort of squeaks and grinds, and is not very pleasant, doesn't make for a very good ride.
Right.
But likewise, suffering here, which is maybe not even a good translation, doesn't mean manifest physical suffering, although it certainly includes that.
Right.
But it can be more a sense of a mild discontent, a sense that there's something not quite right with the world and with one's own life. And that sense of being not quite in one's place, that sense of discomfort, being ill at ease, is at the core of this notion of dukkha, which we could even call simply dissatisfaction.
Yes.
And the Buddha's insight is that this dissatisfaction is not, it is a part of the human condition. It's what we must contend with, but it's not built into our very being. In other words, it's possible for us to lead a life that is not dissatisfied in this way. And the way we do that is to examine what are the causes of that dissatisfaction. And so the second of the Four Noble Truths is what's called the truth of the origin. What is the source of this dissatisfaction? What causes us to feel ill at ease? And it said that that source, when it comes right down to it, is in one way or another a misunderstanding of the nature of the world, a misunderstanding that is especially rooted in a misunderstanding of the nature of our own identity. And so that, our distorted notion of our identities leads to a distorted notion of the world, and that in turn leads us to an incapacity to be effective in the world, and an incapacity to understand what truly will lead to our happiness. So that source, this misunderstanding of the nature of our own identities, can be, as it turns out, resolved. It can be eliminated. And that's really the third truth, the truth of cessation. And here cessation doesn't necessarily mean, although perhaps for the early tradition it did mean something like blowing out the candle, so to speak.
Right.
Or nirvana, that was a pure cessation. But as traditions grow, and especially in the Tibetan traditions, cessation also means transformation, a kind of radical transformation in one's way of being, in one's way of looking at the world, in one's notion of one's own identity. And that radical transformation is called nirvana. The claim, of course, is the Buddha attained nirvana, but many, many other Buddhist practitioners have supposedly obtained nirvana since that time. And the fourth truth is the truth of how they did that, the truth of the path. And that the truth of the path has many different facets. Sometimes one speaks of the Noble Eightfold Path. But a key, the key to that path, especially for the Tibetan traditions, is wisdom and compassion.
Yes.
Those are the two fundamental components through which one progresses toward that radical transformation that is nirvana.
Now, I have a question. Thank you for that answer. It brings so much to mind, especially in how it relates to even, you know, a continuing contemporary journey every day, today.
I think it does. And one can understand perhaps why in a time, perhaps a social dislocation in the Buddha's time, this way of looking at the world and this way of really addressing the fundamental human problem of dissatisfaction and our yearning for happiness could spread so readily throughout Asia, and how also now we see that it has an appeal to a wide segment of our own population, even here in the United States.
Yes, and that's understandable if what you say about the second truth of origin, our dissatisfaction, you know, it could be called broad in our culture.
Indeed.
Today, and the cause of it perhaps not being misunderstanding the nature of our world and our own identities therein. Let's speak a little bit to that, because there's so many practical applications to this before we move along. I believe basically everyone, human beings are good, and that we try always to do our best regardless of what's happening or what can happen in the world. And I believe I believe in our, for example, in the American culture, people are plugging in, and very often because they are told to, and they want to, you know, be part of things and follow where culture tells them to go. At the same time, an incredible busyness is going on, perhaps an inability to unplug. And this must have a tremendous effect on our identity, how we perceive our life, how we perceive our challenges, and that sort of quiet dissatisfaction that's sort of rumbling under the surface about, who am I? Is this what my life is supposed to be? Can you speak a little bit to that in terms of Buddhism and, you know, the path?
Well, it's certainly one of the, you know, part of the problem with that dissatisfaction is actually one might not even notice it. And if one is living in dire circumstances, in great pain, physical pain, in terrible poverty, or whatever it might be, then perhaps the ways in which life are difficult are pretty obvious.
Yes.
And actually, in the Buddhist cosmology, interestingly enough, there's a very vast cosmology involving many different kinds of realms, And among them are deities. Actually, one can be reborn as a deity after one dies, they say, if one's karma is good enough. But in fact, that's considered to be not such a good lifetime because one is living in such great bliss. And there's so little pain, and that dissatisfaction is so far under the surface that one can simply go along and more or less ignore that dissatisfaction until one's very long lifespan comes to an end. And then it's said that the suffering of deities is very intense. Now, I think this tale is interesting for us because I was once with a Tibetan monk. I was taking around a mall, actually, some years ago.
The mall?
Yes, a mall. And we went by a lamp store with all of these chandeliers, crystal chandeliers, and various kinds of lights. And he was in complete awe. He had never seen anything like it at all. And he said, you know, I think America is a god realm. It's a place where divinities live. In a certain way, I think our lives can be very much like that. It's that dissatisfaction that's under the surface, when we have the time, when it surfaces, of course, sometimes in dramatic moments and relationships, at times of illness or whatever it might be. But even perhaps when we sit on the train heading back home after a day of work, that dissatisfaction might emerge slightly. It's said that it's critical to really admit that to oneself, and that the realization of that first truth, the realization of the fact that there is something dissatisfying, is unbelievably important, because without that realization, nothing else is going to make sense in terms of Buddhist practice. So that first moment of realization can be prevented, especially by basically a kind of life of hedonistic pleasure, if you like, or simply having too much to do, so that we don't have the time to sit and look inward. And that's one of the features, an important feature of Buddhist practice, of course, is the capacity to slow down, to start to notice, to pay attention, even moment by moment, to what's occurring in one's mind and one's body, how one is feeling, and not just the dissatisfaction, also the joys and the pleasures, but especially to try to understand oneself in that way. Because the key, of course, if one really, and again, I think the drive here, and Buddhism is more often misunderstood in this regard, by the way. Sometimes.
Yes, please elaborate on that.
Well, often, especially when Europeans first encountered Buddhism, it was thought to be a very pessimistic religion because it talked about suffering and the escape from suffering. But it's not just about escaping from suffering. It's also about obtaining true happiness, genuine, authentic happiness. And the attainment of that genuine, authentic happiness, of course, begins with recognizing the ways in which one's not happy. But to do so, one has to also understand, well, what kind of person am I such that something or other would make me happy? You know, I could be confused and think I'm a car and that I should go down to the gas station and fill myself up with premium gasoline. That's not going to make me happy because obviously I'm not a car. But we can be like that. We can be confused to think that, you know, whatever it might be, a fifth of whiskey or this or that drug or this or that emotional pleasure or whatever it might be is somehow going to satisfy myself. And that might be true if I understood what my true nature were. But if I don't understand what my nature is, who I am, what, in a sense, is my essence. If I don't understand that, then how can I possibly make myself happy? I might as well go pour gasoline down my gullet or something else.
Right.
Because, in fact, I don't have any clue about what might cause my happiness or what might be causing my dissatisfaction. So that key moment of beginning to look inward, beginning to inquire into what is my nature? Who am I? What kind of person am I? What makes me happy, actually? What doesn't make me happy? What causes my dissatisfaction when I notice it? Those questions are key on the Buddhist path.
Now, of course, that's invaluable information, and, you know, we are living in a culture moving faster and faster, it seems. We are constantly giving and receiving bits of information. Our young people have been found to be texting throughout their entire, you know, high school career of classes. Texting through graduation ceremonies. There seems to be a profound lack of what you're speaking of in terms of being grounded within oneself, looking within oneself and not reaching for the next thing to fill up a moment. Would you be speaking then of mindfulness when you discuss slowing down like this and looking within?
That's certainly a central component, the cultivation of what in Buddhism is called mindfulness. Now, of course, there are many, there's some debate about what we mean by that, and there are going to be different traditions and different approaches.
Right.
But there's a style of mindfulness that actually has also been extracted, if you like, from Buddhism and incorporated into various types of clinical interventions that have been found to be very helpful for stress reduction, for the management of pain, in some cases for addiction and so on. And they rest on this key feature that's known as mindfulness. And one way of thinking about mindfulness is it's not simply looking inward. It's not just the capacity to stop for a moment, but it's also a capacity to notice what is occurring. In other words, it's most easily trained when you sit on a cushion and, let's say initially try to watch your breath, for example. This would be a standard way of beginning to learn mindfulness. And when one does that, when you sit on a cushion and you try to watch the flow of your breath, let's say the rise and fall of your abdomen or the flow of the breath at the nostrils, as one does that for a few minutes, what occurs inevitably is that one starts to think about something else. It doesn't take long, usually. Tomorrow's breakfast or this or that relationship or what I have to do in the job. And you can even have quite important realizations while you're sitting there trying to watch your breath. But the key here is not actually to stop those other thoughts. And one misunderstanding of many forms of meditation is that they're about stopping thinking. And that's not what mindfulness, at least in the Buddhist sense, is about.
Right.
It's about noticing how those thoughts arise and what one's relationship to those thoughts are and how one reacts to them. So a good example, something that happens to me I have a busy life, I'll confess, just like the rest of us, I suppose. And I'll be on the cushion doing my mindful meditation and I'll think about something very important at work that really needs to be done. And that moment when that thought arises is not just independent. It's also can be caught up in a whole series of thoughts about what I need to do next, this and that and the other thing. And most importantly, also what it triggers in me. What kinds of anxieties, what kinds of fears, what sense of urgency it might trigger in me. And this style of meditation, again, is not about necessarily stopping those things, but observing how they are arising in that way. Ideally, eventually one gets to the point where one is no longer judgmental, if you like. One is the experiences that arise in meditation and then the experiences that arise in one's ordinary life no longer are like a noose dragging one along. One is no longer caught in one's habitual reactions. And this is part of the reason why it's so effective in the treatment of stress and to some extent in depression, because in many cases for people with depression and certainly people who are stressed, we get caught in habitual streams of thoughts and we don't know how to step outside of them because we take them to be so real. So a big part of mindfulness is noticing that these are occurring, noticing the emotional content, the relationship one has to those thoughts, and then finally what I just referred to, realizing that they're just thoughts. My thought of work or my thought of tomorrow's breakfast is not work or tomorrow's breakfast. I might be thinking of the delicious pancake I will make, but the pancake I think of is not one I can eat. And that is a key realization which also connects to many aspects of Buddhist philosophy. Just realizing that our thoughts are not reality. They're thoughts.
And I imagine, that one of the misconceptions possibly is also that it's an easy thing to do, rather than perhaps some of the more, Abrahamic faiths that we have in the U.S., that sitting, breathing is, it's sort of bypassing that in some, easy way of experiencing spirituality. But I remember, the first time sitting, even physically, my back getting tired.
Yes.
And having to breathe and continue without, thinking, my back is tired.
Yes, right. You can think your back is tired, but the point is not to get caught in that thought.
Yes. Yes. And, there are experiences of mindfulness also in other, faiths. I recall a silent retreat at a Catholic convent, which also included silence at meals.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I did that, I sat down, and of course it was to be mindful of the meal and not be
mm-hmm.
distracted,
mm-hmm.
you know, but to be present with what you are eating.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember having this a massive attack of giggles the first time I did it, sitting there at the dining room table.
Yeah.
I had it like flop sweat.
I've seen it happen myself.
You know, so, and then throughout the weekend, it became much more natural and
yes.
much appreciated.
Well, I think there's a key word that you just used, natural, actually. I mean, the claim here in the Buddhist traditions that speak of mindfulness or something like it is actually that this is, in fact, the nature of our minds. This is the natural way to be. And what we have done, or through various reasons, we can talk about culture, we can talk about biology, if you like, we can update these things in various ways.
Yeah.
But the point is that for some reason or another, that fundamental nature that enables us to actually have thoughts, the capacity to know, the capacity to be aware, that's our fundamental nature, and yet we've lost track of that. So I know, one Buddhist teacher who I'm very fond of, a man named Chökyi Nyingma Rinpoche, who likes to say it's the easiest thing in the world, actually, to get back in touch with that, and yet it's also the hardest. Because it's not really a matter of trying to do something, it's more a matter of stop trying to do things.
Yes.
And so in some ways, maybe to answer your question about it being easy, in some sense I think maybe it is easy. But it's also very, very hard because we are so conditioned to our busy lives. We're so conditioned to our outlooks on the world. It's so difficult for us to shift out of them sometimes.
Yes.
And to step aside. And that's another, I think, interesting feature. You know, when you're let's say, trying to eat mindfully, again...
Imagine, you know, explain what that might be like.
Yeah, well, you know, often one does this very slowly, and one tries to notice each flavor, each different taste in the food. Also notice one's liking and disliking, one's eagerness for more, or one's hope that the next meal won't be quite as bad, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But there's a way of noticing in which the noticing is still very much about oneself noticing this object that is the food. That's one kind of noticing that's very important in mindfulness. But as you are doing that, you... In order to also notice how one feels about it, you know, what's the sort of background, what's the emotional background to all of this? If one is, let's say, eating a delicious strawberry, the enjoyment, the satisfaction of eating the strawberry is not the strawberry itself. It's something happening on one's own side, so to speak. On one's own side is the knowing subject, one term that would be used. And to be aware of that, one cannot simply make oneself into another object, just like a strawberry. One has to be able to cultivate a way of knowing oneself that is like looking out the corner of the eye. And John Kabat-Zinn has told me that one way of thinking about this, and I've seen him write this as well, is as a kind of orthogonal awareness. Orthogonal awareness. Apparently it's some term in quantum physics, I believe.
Okay.
That John likes to use. It
yes.
basically means a kind of awareness that's, in a sense, at 90 degrees to everything else. It's not one's usual sense of, you know, usually we have this sort of standpoint of being at the center of our perceptual world. I'm the one eating. I'm the one walking. I'm the one... being. But here we're trying to cultivate a different sense of experience that is seeing both that sense of subject and the sense of object at once, simultaneously. And that's a deeper form of mindfulness that gets into what's called non-dual awareness, which is also a very important part of some Buddhist traditions. To be able to not lose track, not simply turn oneself into an object, I'm eating a strawberry, as I'm very carefully eating the strawberry, I suddenly look at myself and say, oh, what kind of feeling am I having? That's one way to approach the mindfulness, but another approach is, in a sense, to take a step aside and to watch the whole thing going on, oneself and the strawberry simultaneously. And that kind of awareness is the subtler form of mindfulness that is said to really connect to the nature of consciousness and to our deepest inner nature, that comes obscured in our busy lives.
Well, that's fascinating because, you know, the image you create of, you know, connecting with, you know, being part of, as it were, the strawberry and stepping back, it can extrapolate all the way to the universe.
Yeah, exactly. In other words, it's not here where the strawberry is out there and I'm in here eating it, but in a sense, we are together creating each other. And that's very much part of certain strands of Buddhist philosophy that connect to this idea of emptiness that you mentioned.
Well, this is a fascinating discussion. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. We are going to take a short break, but please stay with us. After the break, we'll continue this fascinating exploration into Buddhism with John Dunn, Associate Professor in the Department of Religion at Emory University. Stay with us. Here is a piece called Becoming Essence by Sambodhi Prem. Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute, live on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. We're talking about Buddhism with author and professor John Dunn of the Department of Religion at Emory University. John?
Mm-hmm.
Before delving more into your particular areas of interest in your work, may I just ask you to briefly address what is at the center of Buddhist life and spirituality?
Well, you know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama often likes to speak of what he calls secular ethics. And that sometimes that term is misunderstood because it sounds as if it's a non-religious, an ethics that is outside of religious traditions. But actually, what he means is that there are a set of values that seem to be almost innately human that occur in many different religious traditions. And where they all intersect are a large core of common values and ethical principles that we can refer to as a secular ethics in the sense that no particular tradition owns them, even though they may be common to all of our traditions.
Yeah.
And a big, in terms of Buddhist life, you know, on the one hand, we are certainly, you could say that one of the fundamental insights of the Buddha himself was that we are driven by happiness. And the problem is that we're confused about happiness. In other words, all beings everywhere, of all kinds, humans and animals, what have you, don't want to suffer and want to be happy. And again, our big problem is that we're confused about what constitutes our happiness and what's causing our suffering. And an interesting feature of Buddhist practice, of Buddhist life, actually is compassion in this regard. There's a great text from the 7th century that His Holiness the Dalai Lama likes to quote by an author named Shantideva. And in that text he says, all those in the world who are unhappy because they're seeking their own happiness. Mm. And all those in the world who are happy because they're seeking the happiness of others. In other words, now this could sound like a way of, you know, one could get a martyr complex and start to blame oneself for wanting to be happy. And that's not the idea here at all.
No.
But rather, it's this sort of self-centeredness. It's being wrapped up in ourselves as if we had some kind of fixed, absolute identity separate from everything else that causes us to suffer. So when our idea of ourselves and therefore our happiness is all wrapped up inside of ourselves, we lead highly dysfunctional lives. But when our sense of ourselves is actually, we see that who we are in some sense is very much connected to everyone else, then seeking happiness is not really a personal enterprise. It's very much seeking happiness for all. And so in certain forms of Buddhist practice, especially in the Tibetan traditions, but really throughout Buddhism, one sees that there's a natural emphasis on compassion, on loving kindness and compassion. And one way of thinking about Buddhist life in practical terms, of course, there's lots of philosophy and so on, which are in a sense aimed simply at getting our misconceptions out of the way, of sort of sweeping away our habitual ways of thinking and all of our conceptual superstructures and all of the garbage that in a way blocks our natural expression of compassion. So that conceptual work, the work with philosophy and so on, can be very important. But on a day-to-day basis, the way that's realized actually is, or what the purpose of that is it to enable one to be a more compassionate person. Person who is seeking happiness, but seeking happiness for all. And so you could say that that principle, I think, lies at the core of Buddhist life, to be a compassionate person.
And the path, then, is a tool that would help to awaken this nature?
Indeed, it would be a tool that would help to awaken this nature, but it is also, in a sense, a manifestation of that nature. In other words, we can, you know, if we get technical about the Buddhist path, that has many different features. But one of its basic principles actually is learning how to lead what we might call an ethical life. And the foundation of Buddhist ethics is non-harm or ahimsa. What that means, of course, is that at the root of one's ethics is a realization that if one is seeking to harm another, that the motivation for that harm is necessarily distorted. Because the claim here is that if one is harming others, one is necessarily caught up in this very self-centered perspective on oneself. So actions that come out of that perspective are going to be harmful. And ethics, the Buddhist ethics is learning how to avoid that kind of harm at its base. But then moving beyond that, one moves from simply not harming to helping. Now one can do all of that without any kind of study of philosophy.
Right.
Because in a certain way, it's putting philosophy in action. One can come to the realizations, the philosophical realizations, without them being expressed in some kind of convoluted language or what have you, simply by leading a life in that way. In other words, there's a claim that by having the basic ethical life that is seeking not just to avoid harm but to help others, that basic path of practice can actually lead to these deeper philosophical realizations about the nature of oneself and reality. So when we think of the path as being rooted, first of all, in that kind of ethics, then that ethics itself is a way of obtaining those realizations, of moving beyond one's own suffering and happiness for self and other, but they're also, in a sense, a manifestation of that very endpoint, a manifestation of what you could call Buddha mind itself. Another feature of the path is training in meditation, and what I'm going to be referring to here are called the three higher trainings. So first we have the higher training in ethics, then the higher training in meditation or concentration. And this, we've actually already touched on this by speaking about mindfulness, but another way of thinking about this is actually the opposite of mindfulness, which is distraction.
Yeah.
So meditation can certainly mean sitting on the cushion, observing one's breath, for example, noticing thoughts, developing that sort of orthogonal awareness, that awareness that steps to the side and is no longer caught up in the habitual ways of thinking. That certainly is meditation. But another way of thinking about meditation is that it's simply stepping aside from the habitual in all of our contexts to no longer be caught up in habitual ways of interacting, to notice what one is doing as one is working, to be fully present moment by moment in whatever one is doing. The opposite of being fully present is distraction. You know, cognitive psychologists and evolutionary psychologists point out that one of the great features of the human brain is this enormous cortex that we have that especially gives us the capacity to what they call time travel. And literally, it's not literal time travel, of course, but for us it is, actually, experientially. I can be sitting at my desk gazing at the computer screen, and I'm not there at all. I'm somewhere yesterday or 10 years ago, or I'm 5 years in the future, or I'm tomorrow. And actually, how often am I truly there? The capacity to time travel is a great resource for us, but it's also a kind of trap.
Yes, because then you come back to yourself and you realize that 5 minutes have passed and you had no awareness of them.
As well, but also, again, we can think that all of that time traveling is real, and that we can think that what I remember of the past is the real past, that somehow that past, which is gone, is still real to me. Or I can think that my imaginings about tomorrow or next year, my anxieties or my hopes and fears, that those are real. They are simply projections.
Yes.
They can be useful projections. They can help me get by in the world. But when they become, the more real they become, the greater the impact they have on my mind and body, and literally on the body, as psychoimmunology will tell us.
Yes.
And that impact is part of this dissatisfaction.
Yes, and when in fact they don't actually exist in the moment.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. So it's taking those things too seriously, in a sense. That's not to say we don't take things seriously. We live, in some ways, being this way, non-distracted, is giving one a much richer life, not a life that is withdrawn, but one that's much more engaged. So in a way, the higher training in meditation is precisely this living the undistracted life. And that doesn't mean you can't be enjoying yourself, you know, out on a bicycle ride or on the dance floor or what have you, but that one is doing that in a way that is not caught up in imaginings, you know, attachments and regrets about the past or hopes and fears for the future. So that's, in a sense, I think, the core of the higher training in meditation on the path. And then a third element that one can use to summarize the path is ethics, meditation, and then finally wisdom. And one aspect of wisdom is certainly studying the philosophical texts, learning philosophy from one's teacher in a traditional context, for example, thinking about, in a useful way, the ways in which thought, for example, distorts one's experience, thinking about the nature of one's own identity and understanding that in lieu of having some kind of fixed absolute identity that is separate from all else, that things have instead an identity that's completely interdependent. Those kinds of realizations can be developed through formal philosophical study. But again, we can also think of these as being something that can happen in moments through the day, as one gets glimpses of one sort of drops below the usual rush of the distraction, and one starts to get glimpses of that more authentic or natural even way of experiencing, in which the world simply appears interdependent to one, in which one's identity appears malleable, changing in a useful way. So those three trainings, the training in ethics, which provides a kind of framework, but is also manifesting, in a sense, the key features of the endpoint, and the training in meditation and the training in wisdom are one way of summarizing the Buddhist path.
Thank you so much for that answer. I would like to explore now a concept that some find joy in it, and some, I'm sure, just the word might be something fearful to them. And I just want to say here, emptiness, which is a key concept in Buddhist philosophy, I believe, it is a supreme mantra coming from the Heart Sutra. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. It's perhaps the most celebrated paradox associated with Buddhist philosophy. Can you please speak to the concept of emptiness in Buddhism and in our lives as a goal?
Sure. Let me, maybe I will start actually, you referred to both emptiness and selflessness, and maybe a good place to start actually is to talk a little bit about selflessness first, if that's all right.
Go ahead.
So one of the key, we talked about the four truths, the dissatisfaction, the origin, the fact of cessation is possible to change, to transform oneself, and then the path that leads to that transformation. And the second one, the origin, is about what is causing our dissatisfaction. And one way of thinking about that, again, is this distorted notion of our identity, that we have a sense of an identity that is disconnected from the world, that is absolute and unchanging, and that in some fashion or another is supreme to all others. We're kind of the king of our own personal universe.
Yes.
And that distorted sense of identity, which is, by the way, the identity that time travels, you know, the sense of I that is the one that gets lost in the imagined past, which is taken to be real, or that wanders into the imagined future, which is taken to be real, that sense of I is really just a fictional character.
Yes, and often one we're trying desperately to hold on to.
Exactly, because there is a fear that if I let go of that kind of I, that somehow I'm going to disappear.
Right.
And the claim is basically you can't lose something you never had.
Yes.
This is not so when the Buddha spoke of selflessness, and when you hear selflessness explained, you know, in all of the Buddhist traditions, really, selflessness doesn't mean that I don't have a self. It means that I don't have that kind of self. I don't have this fixed absolute self. The one that's supposedly exactly the same as I was when I was 5 years old. I like to ask this in class, you know, I say to students, okay, who thinks they're exactly the same person as they were when they were 5 years old? And usually it's a few weeks into the semester, so the students are a little hesitant to answer any questions of that kind by this point. But they say, well, I kind of think that I am, but I know I'm not. And that's the problem, is that we sort of have this feeling that we are somehow the same, but when we reflect on it and we actually observe more closely, we see that we're different. We're even different in different contexts on the same day. We will be different.
Yes.
The claim is there's nothing inauthentic about that. There's nothing wrong with that. Actually, that flexibility is part of our nature, and it's part of what leads to our happiness. So selflessness is learning to let go of the fear that I have to be someone in particular. I have to have this fixed innate identity,
and
something that I truly am.
And I just, if I can interject, what you're saying also speaks to, for example, our relationships.
Exactly.
Perhaps we have a very high divorce rate in the U.S. because of an unwillingness to let go and become whatever this couple needs to become together.
Precisely, yes.
This is a new identity.
That's precisely right, and we can see that between cultures as well and between nations, where the more, I mean, there are advantages, of course, to playing on this feature of the human psyche. The more one emphasizes this sense of a fixed absolute identity, the more one can also raise the fear that someone is trying to steal it away.
Exactly.
So the political use even of this feature of the psyche is a very powerful one. And one could even argue that some versions of sort of jingoistic patriotism are very much along those lines. But putting that aside, then if we think about emptiness, emptiness is just moving that one step further. It's to say that not only is my own fixed not only do I lack a fixed identity, but instead I have an identity, which is an interdependent changing identity, but also that is the case with all things in the world. That we have a tendency, as we go through the day, to objectify things in a very distracted manner, simply label things and to assume that our labels are what those things truly are, and also to assert identities onto things as if those identities were truly there. And in many cases, those identities are precisely, not in many cases, the claim here is all the time, they are going to be of the same nature. In other words, they're fixed, absolute, inflexible.
Can you give just a brief example of what you mean by assigning an identity?
Well, let's say, for example, I might see, I don't know, what would be a good example? Let's see, an iPhone.
Yes.
So I see a thing on my desk, and it's an iPhone. Or so I tell myself. That's how I identify it. And the minute I've identified it that way, then I assume it's the same as all other iPhones, that it has all the features of an iPhone. And often, if I'm even bothering to notice something, and psychologists will tell us this as well, it's somehow relevant to me, i.e. I want it or I don't want it. I like it or I dislike it. So maybe I'm very dissatisfied with my own iPhone, and I see another iPhone on the desk. I identify it as an iPhone. I assume that it's the same as all other iPhones, including my own malfunctioning one. Mm. And so now it is an evil thing, or it is a thing that I wish to dispose of. And we simply go through the world in this fashion. We don't see the particular features of persons or places or of things very often. Some of us do. Of course, there are many extraordinary people in the world, but our habitual ways of, distracted ways of being, are such that we often simply just label things, assume our label to be what that thing truly is, categorize it in such a fashion, and then all of the emotional associations, the desires, the dislikes, and what have you, that are carried along by that category are now placed on that thing. And this can make us very dysfunctional. It can make us very dysfunctional in relationships when we objectify people in that way. It can obviously lead to many cultural problems when we objectify ethnic identities or cultural identities or national identities in that way. And this kind of inflexibility is something, again, that we do habitually. And seeing through that inflexible sense of the identities of things, and instead understanding that each thing is, at this very moment, what it is in relation to me and to all the things around it. It's a unique thing in complete interrelation with all these other things. We can give it a name, but that name will never capture what it truly
right.
is.
Right. You bring to mind the more recent trends in physics.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the book The Tao of Physics, that new strain of, well, newer, let's say, of a science that explores that the deeper down you get into atomic and subatomic physics, the closer you get to Eastern philosophy.
Well, to some extent. I mean, I actually did spend a little time with a physicist in Vienna by the name of Anton Zeilinger.
Yeah.
And the
it's, and when one gets into the details, at least I get easily lost. But I will say that Anton is a brilliant physicist, and he works in an area called quantum optics and information, which they have in his lab was where they first created what's called teleportation, which is actually a slightly misleading term. It means that the information in one quanta was instantaneously appeared in another quanta that was linked to it at a quantum level. And so these this kind of event for Anton is something that seems to rely very much on the role of the observer. And he's starting to move, if I can put words in his mouth, toward a position where it seems that the role of the observer is key in the creation of reality itself. Mm. Now, that's actually a relatively recent idea where the experimental evidence is pointing more and more toward that in quantum physics. And I think the vast majority of quantum physicists will still resist that type of notion. That is a notion that moves more toward the Buddhist view, however, which is basically that we are mutually constantly creating our reality, all of us, together. And which is, of course, why things like the environmental crisis and poverty are not simply issues to be solved by someone else.
Yes. I'm with you.
Yeah.
So there's a great pertinence and potential, then, of Buddhism in our contemporary culture and how we address corporate sufferings.
I think there is. It's of course, it's Buddhism can sometimes be a fad in various contexts, and there are ways in which perhaps it's misunderstood here and there. But another key issue is that it's not necessarily the case that one has to become a Buddhist, or even say that I'm interested in Buddhism in order for some of these ideas and practices to be effective. You know, when Jon Kabat-Zinn developed mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is this program that incorporates some features of Buddhist meditation techniques.
Yes.
For the treatment of, initially, actually mostly for pain initially, some 25 years ago, and now for many other things as well. That he would have people from every walk of life, because he was initially in a pain clinic, and so we'd have construction workers who were devout Catholics from Boston, and you know, Orthodox Jews, and people from all different traditions who were participating, and it was never necessary to even use the word Buddhism, and he didn't actually
use the
word Buddhism, because there are definitely techniques that are available here and insights that are, first of all, many of them already present in a number of the world's traditions, although perhaps have been somewhat de-emphasized more recently.
Yes, I believe other faiths share similar goals and even, you know, practices of hollowing oneself out for others. We explore these things on this program.
I bet you
and
do.
It's lovely and beautiful to hear people around the world who enjoy this in their lives and enjoy helping others as you do. You can hear a little bit of closing music starting, which means we're at the end of this program. But I feel there's so much to discuss. I may need to invite you to come back, Dr. Dunn.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you, Carol. I hope we can work out a time.
Thank you. We're just scratching the surface here on a very important tradition in our world. But I want to thank you so much for being with us today, John.
Thank you, Carol, and thank you for all your work. It seems like a wonderful program.
Thank you. And thank you, listeners, for joining us live for the Godspeed Institute today. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous shows again, or send it to someone, simply go to progressiveradionetwork.com and click on the archive link. We hope you enjoyed the show today and hope you will join us again as we continue to explore the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, Godspeed.